Okay, this is the first place I'm sharing about what I've been quietly working on. It's called the Mental Fitness Blueprint. It's a 90-day, deeply personal map for training your mind to work for you, not against you. And I'm opening this up to just 50 founding members. So if this podcast has ever helped you slow down or see yourself more clearly, this is your invitation. Details are in the show notes or at mchampagne.com. Who are you?
What a great question. I am a motivated curiosity nerd. Once I get curious, right? Once I get curious about something, I just keep going and going and going into it. And I try to figure out ways in whatever my curiosity is that it can be beneficial sometimes to me, but in more cases than not, how can I bring something or this information out to the public? Because I usually think, like, if I've got questions about this area, there's got to be other people like me who are super curious and looking for answers. And so I think that fundamentally is one of the aspects of kind of who Michael is. I would say, if you ask me, like, what's your superpower? I'd say my superpower is taking really complicated science and bringing it into bite-sized actionable chunks. And so when you take those two aspects and you put them together, it allows me to then educate. I think at the bottom line, I'm an educator, and I love, if I'm really honest with you, I don't mind the attention and being out front and kind of being the tip of the spear. And I like being an expert. And it took me a while to get comfortable with the idea of being an expert. It wasn't necessarily something that I just fashioned myself to and was like, hey, everybody, I'm an expert. But I feel like I can do some good with it.
I love it. I did want to talk to you about superpowers, so you set me up really well on that.
Oh, there you go.
Since a lot of the people on this show are here because they want to focus on their mind and their mental fitness and just get their minds to work for them instead of against us, if I think of even myself, if I want to be at peak levels of mental fitness, how do I use sleep as my superpower?
Great, great question. So first of all, let's take a half a step backwards and identify, like, what does sleep affect, right?
Yes.
Like, where does sleep go in the body? Because while it is both physiologically restorative, which we can, you know, I can go ad nauseum on how many different medical systems in your body are affected by sleep. By the way, every single one of them, you know, like literally. But, you know, when you're talking about mental fitness and kind of thinking through that as a rubric, you just can't do it without sleep. I mean, sleep affects us, for example, for memory. Right. So we know that REM sleep in particular is where you move information from your short-term memory to your long-term memory. You kind of create this organizational substructure in your head, kind of like a filing cabinet to slot data that's coming in through your eyes, through your ears, through your nose and your mouth, so that you can retrieve it later on to either solve problems or, you know, enact protocols like riding a bike or, you know, answering a question or things like that. So memory is a very big portion of what happens during sleep. But also cognition. You just don't think well when you are sleep deprived. Now, sleep deprivation, one thing I think a lot of people misunderstand is people think of sleep deprivation as like, oh, I only got 6 hours of sleep. That's not sleep deprivation. I know people who can get 6 hours of sleep and be sharp as tack, right? What we're talking about is quality of the sleep that you're getting. And by the way, the amount is going to vary throughout your lifetime based on a whole host of topics, everything from age to stress levels for women, where you are in your period, where you are in your life cycle in terms of pregnancy or menopause. All of those things can make you sleep deprived. And so people need to be constantly thinking to themselves, okay, when I wake up in the morning, how do I feel? Now, to be clear, it's not about checking your tracker, right? Now, trackers are fine, right? You can have a tracker, you can have a ring, you can have a wristband, you can have whatever. They're all fine, but that's not really depth of sleep. None of them can actually measure that at a real interesting level or an accurate level, because when we look at sleep staging and the depth of the sleep, it's measured by electroencephalogram. So it's measured by EEG, right? It's hard to get EEG from your finger, right? Or from your wrist. So I'm not talking about when you wake up in the morning and say, oh, you know, my ring said I got a 75. What I'm talking about is I believe that you are your best doctor. When you wake up in the morning and the cobwebs clear, how do you feel? Mm-hmm. If you feel like you're well slept, there's a really damn good chance that you are, right? Now, once you understand whether or not you're sleep deprived or not, then we start to get into this whole idea of mental wellness, mental fitness, being able to really utilize our brains at the top level. And it's funny that you asked me this question, because I've started to come up with a kind of an overwhelming theory. I'd love to share it with you.
Please.
I was listening to this, every once in a while I listen to philosophers and people who are, you know, kind of espousing all this kind of interesting stuff. And one of the guys I was listening to, his name is Naval, he said that the currency of life is time. That makes sense to me. So how I spend my time is kind of an accumulation of what my life sort of looks like. And then he said, and this is Buddhism, this is him, he said, and the currency of time is attention. So what do we attend to is where we spend our time, and where we spend our time makes up our life. My addition to this idea is, I think that the currency of attention is sleep. Right?
Tell me more.
So, you know, if you don't sleep well, I can show you data that says that you can't, short-term attention is gone. You can't pay attention to hardly anything. Long-term attention also is not something that you can do. So fundamental to who we are as a human. And that's not just our cognitive, our memorial function, our personality too. Like, let's mm-hmm. be fair. You know somebody that hasn't slept well when they walk into the room, like they throw off a vibe, right? They're just like, yeah. Leave me alone. Like, I'm not interested. And they don't even realize half the time they're doing it. And so I think sleep really consumes, it has to start with sleep, right? Because otherwise you're really at a big disadvantage for any level of mental fitness.
Well, you're always, my take is you're always kind of swimming upstream.
In what way?
In the sense, if your sleep is not dialed in, it doesn't matter. 100%. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You're swimming. And I think it varies. Like, you're either in a wave pool getting smashed or you could be going kind of with the current kind of scenario. Like, that's at least how I see it in my mind. It's
kind of like an anchor that's like weighing around your neck while you're trying to do almost anything. And I believe that anchor gets lifted or gets lighter as you sleep. Now, don't get me wrong. There are other anchors, right? Stress, you know, for some people, substance abuse, you know, what have you. Those are all things that can come in and really weigh you down mentally, emotionally, cognitively. But sleep's a biggie. Yeah. Sleep and hydration, I would say, are two of the biggest things that people don't really think about. And I wrote my most recent book is called Sleep, Drink, Breathe. Wellness is Too Complicated. Because number one, wellness is too complicated. But without these fundamental aspects of your life being on par, man, everything else is tough.
Oh, for sure. Well, and I love that they're the fundamentals for a reason. But for some reason, we overcomplicate all of this stuff and we forget the basics, right? It's like, yeah, I'll get all of these trackers and do all of these different routines and so forth. But at the end of the day, I mean, I love how you come back, ask the question. I mean, this is a podcast on this side where it started out of a journaling app based on questions. So.
There you go.
I mean, you know, just taking time to check in with ourselves. We can get a lot of data there, right? And coming back and then making some tweaks and adjustments and experiments and so forth.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is important to realize is that sleep is tricky sometimes, because we actually have a mechanism in our brain that as we get more sleep deprived, it tells us we're okay, right? And this goes back way back evolutionarily speaking. So when you were getting tired, when you were in the, you know, Neolithic caveman, cavewoman days, right? If you laid down to take a nap, you were probably dinner for the local dinosaur.
Yeah.
And so there's a part of your brain that just says, hey, ignore it, right? Like, keep going. And caffeine really doesn't help that scenario at all. Caffeine masks a lot of those sleep deprivation signs and symptoms. And let's be fair, like, if we wanted to talk about what is society really addicted to, like, dude, if we get rid of caffeine, we're going to have a lot of cranky, angry people, you know? and people think that caffeine is a substitute for sleep, and it's not. It masks a lot of the symptoms of sleep deprivation. Like, I've had I had a third of a cup of coffee this morning, and I only had that because I like to have that right before I go to the gym. I have it 90 minutes after I wake up, so I hydrate beforehand to make sure that my body is well hydrated. Most people don't know, but sleep in and of itself is a dehydrative event. You lose almost a full liter of water every night just from the humidity in your breath. But caffeine is not a big, big part of my life because I kind of don't need it. You know, caffeine has no nutritional value whatsoever. It's really, people use it primarily to just keep them getting up and going. Now, I will be fair. There are some people out there who have issues. Like if you have ADD and ADHD, caffeine might be helpful to you, or medication might be helpful to you. Those stimulants can, I mean, look, there's plenty of data to show that some of those can really help zone you in and get you going. But at the same time, you got to be careful with caffeine. I mean, one of the biggest issues in the sleep universe that I deal with is people don't understand things like what is the half-life, what is the quarter life, when should I start, when should I stop? And practically speaking, there are guidelines. Like, I mean, we can talk about them today, but there are guidelines for people in that area, because a lot of times what people will do is they'll over-caffeinate, and then by the end of the day, they're done, dude. They're cooked. They're what I call wired and tired. Right. So they're stimulated through the caffeine, but their body is so freaking exhausted that this unbalanced scenario really becomes problematic, specifically for sleep. And then they're just kind of in the washing machine cycle doing it over and over and over.
Yeah. What about, I have to ask, I mean, it seems like sleep and the topic of sleep, thankfully, is more and more, you know, kind of in mainstream conversation. And of course, a lot because of your work as well and your books.
Thanks.
And so forth. But also there's a lot of interesting things out there. And I know two topics that are probably most discussed, and I think you've got some different opinions on them, blue blockers and mouth tape.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. And I will say, can't wait to chat about this. I do mouth tape, and this could be completely placebo, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I found that within maybe a week or so after feeling like I've been taken hostage in my bed with
terrible
tape, that I was waking up feeling more refreshed. And like my mouth and because if I don't wear it, I can tell you right away with my mouth, my throat's drier, I'm mouth breathing and so forth. But give us your take on this.
Yeah. So let's talk about mouth tape first. Then we'll talk about blue blockers. And then I think I want to add in the topic of the 5 a.m. club, because that's also
Robin Sharma.
Yeah. That's also a big one. So I was quoted fairly recently in the Wall Street Journal, where I said the 5 a.m. club is the second stupidest idea I've heard, other than mouth tape being number one. Okay. So I'm pretty opinionated about
line.
It. By the way, Robin and I are friends.
Yeah.
He and I have had this discussion many, many times. I'm also good friends with Hal Elrod, who does the Miracle Morning stuff, who's, by the way, a really great guy. And by the way, so is Robin. But here's the thing. Mouth tape is dangerous. Let me explain why.
Okay.
So the problem with mouth tape is, number one, you're correct. It can be effective. People, after 7 to 10 days of wearing mouth tape, they actually feel better. However, if you have not been screened for obstructive sleep apnea, it masks all the symptoms. Your apnea can get significantly more severe. And then you have a real problem on your hands, right? If you can attack apnea early on, the solution set is much wider. It's much easier. We can do a lot more for people who've got, you know, very mild apnea. But when you tape your mouth shut, we have no idea if you have apnea or not. Number two, there was a really interesting meta-analysis done on all the studies on mouth tape, which, by the way, there aren't a ton, but there were like maybe 10. People have died using mouth tape. No shit. Like, people have asphyxiated using mouth tape, right? What I do with mouth tape is I say, I think it doesn't pass what I call the mom test, which is call up your mom and say, hey, mom, I'm thinking about taping my mouth shut while I sleep, and see what her reaction is, right? She's going to say, you know, it's probably good during the day, so I don't have to listen to you, but that's a really stupid idea, Michael, right? Here's why, is because the people out there who are selling mouth tape, and by the way, there are tons of them out there. They have no idea what they're doing. I've talked about this to, I mean, so many companies have come to me, dude, and been like, hey, we want you to endorse our mouth tape. I'm like, have you looked at the clinical research on this? Like, you're an idiot. If you have a deviated septum, if you have inflated turbinates or adenoids, all these different things that go on inside the nasal oral cavity, right? And you use mouth tape, like you're really doing yourself an incredible disservice, and it is flat out dangerous. There's okay. just no, I mean, I'll you know what we'll do? We'll put in the show notes. I'll send you the study so that way people can actually look at the real study and be able to see. Now, if you did a sleep study and you don't have apnea and you don't have a deviated septum, mouth tape might be perfectly fine. But let's get to the core reason of why people use mouth tape. People use mouth tape because they have congestion and their mouth drops open when they sleep. That's it. That is the main reason. So putting something across your mouth really doesn't change anything out there, okay? Go to an ENT, get on a nasal steroid spray, or use some saline wash before bed. You will be pleasantly surprised at how much better you sleep just by fixing your nose and nasal cavity. I mean, honestly, people should be running to the ENT, not, you know, going to the CVS and buying, you know, I had somebody put duct tape on their mouth. Like, you have to remember, like, a lot of people, they don't think about it medically speaking. You know, they're like, hey, I've got some tape. I've heard this on TikTok. I might as well give it a shot. Again, I think it's dangerous. I don't think it's wise. And if you've got undiagnosed sleep apnea, you could be in for a real problem on your hands.
Yeah.
Now, also, if you're going to use mouth tape, be intelligent about it. It doesn't go horizontally across. It's a small piece of medical tape, so it doesn't rip your skin off your lips, that goes vertical up and down. Right? Yeah. That's the way you want to do something like this, if in fact you want to do it. Blue blockers. Mm. This is a great question. And I'm going to be honest with you, the data ain't great. A long time ago, I created my own line of blue light blocking glasses and I sold them. To be fair, the data now is really showing that it's not the blue light from your phone that's keeping you awake. It's the engagement with Facebook, right? Or let me put it to you this way. If you're trying to get your high score on Candy Crush, you ain't trying to go to bed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you just don't need that. And the problem here, when we get down to the biology of it all, is there are two systems in the brain that help you fall asleep. One is called sleep drive. The other is called sleep rhythm. Both of those need to be in sync in order for you to fall asleep. However, the sleep drive and sleep rhythm can both be thrown off by levels of arousal. When you're getting dopamine hits by flying through your level of arousal is higher. So you're literally giving yourself the antidote for sleep when you're playing on your phone. And blue light blocking glasses, they don't affect it one way or another. Blue light blocking glasses worked a long time ago when people were in industrial situations where they had these huge fluorescent lights that were coming on. Back in the 70s, they used to have these things called blue blockers, and they were selling them all over TV, and it was kind of a big deal. But I would argue that now, I don't think the data really stands up anymore. Now,
so
the
where does
5 a.m.
Yeah, just on that one, just because sure. I think there's probably a lot of people that, again, because these are topics that are all over the place and like anything, get jammed into this binary kind of answer for everything, right? But if you think of, and just knowing the audience here too, like a lot of people are probably reading before bed, but maybe they might be using an iPad or a Kindle, and that's where like some of the concern, like, well, I want to read and calm down. I don't want to watching TV and doing things that are stimulating my brain, but then everyone's saying the blue light's going to be messing with my sleep.
Yeah.
So
Here's what I'll tell you. Yeah, the data doesn't really support it. Now, if you look at a computer screen all day long and you have terrible eye strain, it might not be a bad idea.
Sure.
The amount that blue light is going to affect you has a lot to do with how much blue light exposure you got throughout the daytime, right? So you need to be thoughtful about it. What I would do is try it without. Here's the good news. They're not going to hurt you. I wouldn't go out spending hundreds of dollars on fancy-schmancy blue light blocking glasses. Now, I will tell you that there are some blue light blocking glasses that are actually really good. They block out absolutely all of the blue light. I've used them on occasion on plane flights instead of an eye mask. I found that to potentially be effective at times. But generally speaking, I just don't think the data is strong enough for us to really say, hey, this is a great idea. Is it okay to use them? Sure. Is it going to hurt you? I'm pretty sure it's not. Yeah. But I wouldn't break the bank on your next pair of blue blockers.
Sure. But I do like the added question of whether you're using them or not, just thinking of, are you stimulating your brain 2-3 hours before bed in an excessive amount?
Yeah, dude, that's the right question. I try to explain to people all the time, you need runway to land the plane. okay? And that runway is really up to you. I created a little system called the power down hour. So what I do is, let's say your bedtime is 11. I have you set an alarm for 10 p.m. and have it be an alarm that's in your bedroom, not on your wrist or on your phone, where you have to physically walk into your bedroom so you see the surroundings and remember, oh, shit, I need to start the runway. And then you take that hour and you chop it up into three 20-minute segments. So 20 minutes for just stuff you got to do. Otherwise, it's going to cause you crazy thoughts, you know, like the last email, getting your kids' backpacks together, lunches, lay out your clothes, whatever. 20 minutes for hygiene, and then 20 minutes for some form of meditation, relaxation, prayer. You could do, there's a whole host of things that you could do during that period of time. And is it okay to watch TV? Of course it is, right? Like I'm literally, I think, the only sleep doctor in the universe that says, hey, it's fine to watch TV to fall asleep. Dude, in my house, we have a big screen TV. It's on all night long, okay? My wife couldn't fall asleep without a TV on, no matter how hard she tried. And I'll tell you why, is because she uses it to prevent something I call monkey mind. Right. Okay. So it's a distraction. 90% of the time, her eyes aren't even open. Right. She's just listening through like the corner of her ear at some old episode of Seinfeld or something like that. And it's just enough to keep her mind attuned to that. So she's not thinking about all the different things that might have gone on during the daytime or things like that. That's formally called ruminative thought. Okay. Yeah. Now, is television the best way to do that? No, of course it's not. You try to fix something in your journal and see how well that freaking goes, okay, exactly. Bro? Like it doesn't happen, right?
You but gotta weigh things out in life.
Right, but are there better techniques? Of course there are. I was talking with a patient this morning about ruminative thought. And look, let me give your audience a few thoughts here. Number one, if you've got stuff that's circling your brain all the time and you want to get rid of it, count backwards from 300 by threes. Yeah, it's mathematically so complicated. It keeps your mind occupied, and it's so damn boring, you're out like a light, right? Yeah. There's a technique called cognitive shuffling. This is a well-known, well-documented technique where you take a word. So let's pick the word, I don't know, sunflower, right? Okay. And then you take the first letter of the word, which is S, and then you have to come up with seven words that start with the letter S. And then you move on to the next letter, which is U, and the next letter, which is N. So what this does is it mimics a little bit that desperate thoughts that are kind of flying through your head right before you go to bed and helps you, again, distract you from your worries, allowing you to fall asleep. My favorite technique that I personally use if I'm having issues with sleep is called 4-7 breathing. So this is developed by Dr. Andrew Weil, not me, super smart, Harvard-trained naturalist guy. Believe it or not, he developed it for the military. And it's really interesting technique. So it's exactly what it says it is. You slowly breathe in for a count of four, you hold for a count of seven, and then you push out gently for out of your mouth, by the way, for a count of eight. So it's in through the nose for four, hold for seven, push lightly for eight. What's fascinating about this technique is when you get through about 20 cycles, it dumps your heart rate to about 60 beats a minute. Now, why is that important? In order to enter into a state of unconsciousness, you need a heart rate of about 60 or below. Now, don't get me wrong. If there's people out there who've got high blood pressure and things like that, they may never get their heart rate that low. But the name of the game here is lowering your heart rate. Why I like 4-7-8 so much is what I have people do is I have their picture the number in their mind's eye with their eyes closed. So when they're breathing in, they see they in the mind, they see a 4, then a 3, then a 2, then a 1. And while they're holding, they see these numbers. You can't count and think at the same time. And so it distracts you. But if you're following the breathing lowers your heart rate. This is a twofer, right?
Yeah,
rarely in life can you do one thing that does two good things for you. This is one of those things. Now, I'll be honest with you. When I first started doing it, it was hard for me to hold for seven and push for eight. So I modified it. And so I start out doing 4-5-6 breathing for maybe 2 weeks. Then I moved to 4-6-7 breathing. And then I got to 4-7-8 breathing. So don't beat yourself up if you can't get there. Modify it to whatever you want. The other thing that I want to tell people, if you're going to try 4-7-8 breathing, which by the way, I recommend that you do. And if I'm talking too fast, swing on over to my YouTube channel. I've got a whole video just on 4-7-8 breathing. We can put it into the show notes if people want. Is I take my hands and I lightly make fists and put them down by my side. And when I get through one cycle of 4-7-8, I stick out a finger. In a second cycle, I stick out a finger. And when I get to 10, then I wrap my fingers back and I've hit 20. So now I'm doing something cognitively to distract me. I'm doing something respiratorily. I don't even know that's a word, respiratory, to be able to breathe. And I'm doing something distally. Dude, you can't think of anything else when you're doing that.
Out like a light. That's great. Yeah. Those are so good. And I love the Scrabble for sleep. Have you talked to them about that?
Scrabble for sleep. I never thought of it that way. That's a great line. I'm going to use that.
For sure. All right. Let's talk about our good friend, Mr. Sharma.
Yeah.
Canadian, by the way.
5 a.m. Club.
Yeah.
So here's the thing is everybody inside of them has something called a chronotype. Now, people might not have heard of this term before, but you have heard of the vernacular, which is if anybody out there has ever been called an early bird or a night owl, those are chronotypes. Here's why the 5 a.m. Club, I think, is a terrible idea. It's genetic. You don't get to choose which one you are. Only about 15%, 15% of the population actually can do this with some regularity and be successful at it. So why would you want to tell 85% of the people out there to try something that, genetically speaking, is going to be incredibly difficult for them to do? It doesn't make sense to me. What I would say to do, and I talked about this with Robin, I talked about it with Hal, Hal from Miracle Morning, Elrod, is figure out what your chronotypical wake time and bedtime is and follow that. Okay. Yeah. Now the next question is, Michael, how do we know what our chronotype is? I got a quiz online. People can do it. By the way, it's based on science. It's not Michael making this stuff up. We'll put it in the show notes. It's called chronoquiz.com. And it's really interesting because you can figure this thing out and it kind of becomes like the best cheat code ever. Because not only do you learn when your body, and by the way, this is based on when melatonin is propagated and then when cortisol is propagated. This is strict biology, okay? Like, again, this isn't me coming in and saying, oh, I'm going to take something and you know, mess around with it. This is exact. So early birds, their melatonin turns off at about 4:30 in the morning. Their cortisol spikes and they're up and going. But for a night owl, which is what I used to be, that stuff doesn't start until 7:30. So when you're trying to get up at 5 a.m. and your melatonin is still going till 7:30 in the morning, it's a freaking disaster.
Yeah, you're going to feel terrible.
Exactly.
So what I'm assuming, having studied a lot of Robin's work, the conversation or where you guys probably landed was his whole thing is just the whole idea is to do important work before life and people, you know, try to distract you, but you figure out what that time is, what's most appropriate.
Yeah, okay. I love his theories. I love his thoughts. I just don't like the time he tells everybody to do it.
Yeah, exactly. One thing I wanted to speak with you about that I haven't seen you talk too much about on other shows and so forth, but just is your fascination and interest around dreams.
Oh, yeah.
And dreaming. And I'll just leave it open. Like where do you start or what do we need to know about dreams? And because there's so much out there around, like, you can analyze your dream, you can do this, you can do that. But all your approaches are just a little bit different, which I love. And I'm sure you do too.
Maybe I'm just a little bit different. When we talk about dreams and dreaming, to take a slight step backwards, so that people know, like, I'm a board certified sleep specialist. I treat people's sleep disorders, apnea, narcolepsy, insomnia, things like that. Almost nowhere in the training for that do they discuss dreams. Almost nowhere. I have a bit of a unique background. To be clear, I am not an MD. I have a PhD in clinical psychology. I did do something that was kind of weird. I took the medical boards without going to medical school and passed. I'm one of 168 people in the world that have ever done it. So that's why I understand the biology side of sleep so well. But my main focus is on the psychology side of sleep. You know, we just didn't learn anything about dreams, at least in the program that I was in. Now, I was in what's called a cognitive behavioral program. If somebody out there had studied in, for example, a psychoanalytic program based on Freud and Jung, then they probably got a lot of dream information and things of that nature. But what I discovered over time was most people don't go to those types of psychologists and psychiatrists because that's daily, hour-long to three-hour-long therapy. Who has time for that? Like, I totally get it. I think it's valid. And I think there's some really cool aspects to it. But in the kind of fast-paced world that we're in these days, I don't think that a lot of people have had exposure to those types of therapists. So that's number one. Number two, man, there's a lot of cool movies about dreams, right? You know, there's Inception, there's Dreamscape, there's all these kind of cool, fun things. And Hollywood's done a fun job of getting people excited about dreams. Unfortunately, it hasn't been particularly accurate. And that can be slightly problematic. The area of focus in dreams that I've spent some time in over the last year and a half has been nightmares. And nightmares turn out to be an incredibly serious, difficult problem for people. You know, an interesting statistic is every single day, 18 veterans commit suicide. Every day. So it's about every 80 to 90 minutes. And they all have something called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the hallmark symptoms of PTSD are nightmares. Okay, so let's for a second, let's define what a nightmare truly is. So when you look into the nosology or the criteria that sleep doctors use to define these different disorders, by the way, there's 88 different sleep disorders. I mean, who knew you could mess up your sleep 88 different ways, right? That's crazy. A nightmare is, and this is different than a night terror. So a lot of people say to me, oh, I've got night terrors. Hold on a second, you might not. Nightmares are a situation, by the way, they usually occur mostly in REM sleep, which happens in the latter third of the night. And what happens is it's a very scary dream where people have to wake up from it. Okay. You are fully awake. You are fully cognizant. And when somebody turns to you and asks you questions about the nightmare, you can repeat in very specific detail exactly kind of what went on. A night terror is very different. Number one, night terrors generally occur in children more so than they do in adults.
Yeah.
And night terrors is where my daughter had them, so I know it really well, where you sit up and you just scream bloody murder, and then everybody runs in the room like, oh my God, what's going on? And then they fall back asleep. And then the next morning you ask them how they slept, and they say, I slept fine. What are you talking about? So they have
is
no
that normally memory. Happened at the beginning of their sleep cycle?
Exactly. Exactly.
So
you nailed it.
We have a 4-year-old happened on Sunday, and it was, gosh, it was a disaster for probably 4 hours, like just up and up, up, down, down.
And so let's talk about a quick way about how to treat that so we can help your 4-year-old. So the data would suggest she'd be happy too. So what the data would suggest is about 30 to 45 minutes after the person or child has gone to bed, you walk in and you gently wake them up and ask them 2 or 3 questions, like what's your middle name? What day of the week is it? You know, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Just enough to get them to think and then have them go back to sleep. While I can't put my finger on the exact mechanism of why this works like 70 to 80% of the time in terms of reducing the frequency and the intensity of the night terrors. But this is what we think this is it has something to do with the transitionary period between a light and deeper sleep, especially for children. Nightmares, which I want to get back to.
Yep.
Very different. You got a script in your head, you remember it, and it is scary as shit. Okay.
Yeah.
That situation becomes very, very important when we talk about the suicidality and post-traumatic stress disorder, because what ends up happening is veterans don't want to go to sleep.
Mm.
The movies that are playing in their head are freaking awful, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in learning how to help that. And now I don't take it lightly that people, you know, put themselves in harm's way for my freedom. And so whether you're a first responder, you know, a firefighter who comes in and saves somebody, whether you're a military, whether you're a police officer, or quite frankly, almost any traumatic event, rape, natural disaster, you name it, these can all cause nightmares. Now, the question becomes, well, why in REM sleep? And what's the purpose of nightmares? Because most things seem to have a purpose. REM sleep is what I call emotional metabolism, okay? So during REM sleep, like we were talking about before, you move information from your short-term memory to your long-term memory, you actually process emotions during REM sleep, right? So as an example, if you have a really depressing day, you're going to probably have a little bit more REM sleep than you normally do. Or if you have a particularly joyous day, you're going to have, again, it's where we process our emotions. And so when we're talking about a nightmare and you're going through this narrative and you wake up, you stop the processing. You never finish processing. And so when you go back to sleep, you go back to the beginning of the dream and you go, and then you stop processing, right? So we have to figure out ways, shapes, and forms to allow that processing to continue. Now, here's the good news. There's like 6 different types of nightmare and dream therapies. Now, I want to be very, very clear here. I'm not talking about dream interpretation. Dream interpretation is, I mean, I hate to say it this way, but it's almost like a parlor trick, right? It doesn't have a lot of real utility in my world. Like, now, to be clear, there are some dreams that seem to be universal, right? So teeth falling out is a dream that many, many people in all kinds of cultures, by the way, like I speak all over the world. And in many, many cultures, they say things, they tell me, oh my gosh, Michael, like we have these kind of dreams all the time. So it's fascinating to me that there are different themes in dreams. The dream, the falling is another very common theme. Showing up for an exam naked or completely unprepared. Again, these are themes of dreams that we can see. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is using the dream in the therapeutic context. Let me explain. I spent the last year and a half working towards and becoming what's called a dream therapist. Again, not interpretation, this is therapy. So I was very fortunate. I was working with world-renowned dream therapist and dream teacher. And we had a class and it was great. There was like 30 of us and we paired up and we would talk about our dreams and we would go through this therapeutic process. Now, again, there are several different ones out there. There's Freudian, there's Jungian. Again, those are a little bit longer term. Quite frankly, I'd have to go through 4 to 6 years of training before I could get to that level of something like that. And I think that's a real lifelong pursuit. And I have a lot of respect for the people that do that, but it just wasn't kind of my bend. There's cognitive behavioral therapy that you can do where you look at some of the ideas and you look at the truth behind them and how do you reframe a lot of those ideas. There's something called image rehearsal, rehearsal therapy. This is where people write out the dream and then they rescript the ending. So instead of becoming the victim, you are now the victor. And when people do that, after a certain period of time and a certain number of sessions, you actually change the content of the dream, which is kind of
so
cool.
You can stop the nightmares or finally process them.
Exactly. The one that I've been trained on was started by a gentleman by the name of Eugene Genlin. And he believes that there are somatic components to the dream. Like you can feel in your body different things and your body can be telling you different things about the dream. But the basics of the protocol are quite interesting. You can do it on Zoom, you can do it one-on-one, you can do it in a group. But what you do is you have the client come in and you put them into a mild hypnotic state. And to be clear, it's not like they're walking around clucking like a chicken, right? It's you know, it's breath work to just kind of get you relaxed and get you feeling safe. Because you're going to walk down a path with somebody and they need to trust you and they need to feel safe. They're going to tell you about some of their deepest, darkest, scariest stuff. So you want to create that situation where they can do that. They go through the entire dream. Well, they get to the end where they usually wake up. And then you as the therapist turn to them, their eyes are closed, and you say, okay, let's drop into the dream together. Now, to be clear, this is not Inception. I do not have electrodes attached to their head, and I'm not bombing into their brain, right?
Come on.
Well, I know. Wouldn't that be cool? Eventually, maybe. What we're doing here is we're using daydreaming to advance the processing. So everybody out there has daydreamed at time to time. You know, you're staring out the window, 5 minutes go by and you're thinking about something. Turns out that only about 15 to 20% of what's in a dream is real and factual. About 80% is imagination. So we can use
why
this
day. Do we know?
I don't know why.
That's interesting.
That's the stats as far as I know them. What's interesting is when you start to look at this idea here of daydreaming and you say, let's drop into the dream together, you are now actually asking them to daydream what the next step is. They feel safe. They're with you. Part of the reason people, I think, wake up is because they're by themselves. You know, when you're dreaming, it's your narrative, right? It's always through your eyes 99% of the time. And you can't really turn to somebody and say, hey, I need a little help here. I'm feeling a little scared. You're kind of going on and doing your thing. Whereas in this situation, you've got a trained therapist with you who can sit there and kind of walk you through things and make you feel safe. So there's a lot that goes on here, but based on what's going on, the therapist is there, by the way, not to interpret, but merely to guide. So the first thing that you do is when you drop into the dream together is you turn to the person and you say, hey, I want you to scan your body and I want you to tell me where is the place that is the warmest or that you feel is the safest. And you leave it open-ended like that and they kind of scan their body. A lot of times it's the center of the chest. Some people say it's the back of the neck. Some people say it's their gut, right? And then you turn to them and you say, okay, that is your safe place. If we get into a situation that becomes very, very scary, because remember, they're still awake. right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're just in this kind of mild state. I want you to put your hand there and realize that you're safe, right?
Okay.
So it's an anchor point that they can use while they're daydreaming the scary shit that's usually happening at night. And you start walking them around the dream and you just start asking questions like, why are we here? Describe the scenery. Who is here? What did they say? And all of a sudden, what ends up happening is you actually are helping them process the dream, but it's during the day using a daydream. And guess what happens? After about 8 to 10 sessions, it changes the dream at night. And they start to emotionally process through it. And then it all ends up being, it all ends up working out really well.
So it's like that.
It's really fascinating when I've been doing this. I've been doing this for about 1.5 years. I'm working on several different projects with it. I'm taking on clients that have these issues because I'm fascinated by it. And the goal is to lower the frequency and the intensity of the dreams, because for me, the statistic that really kind of rings out the most is suicidality. So as intensity and frequency of dreams increase, so does suicidality. And if every 18 veterans kill themselves a day, I'd like to figure that problem out. Like, people shouldn't be afraid to go to sleep, Mark. Like, that's a bottom line.
For sure. But unfortunately, it kind of makes sense from what you've been sharing that if you're afraid to go to sleep and then now you're slowly or quickly sleep depriving yourself, we
absolutely
know where that goes. And again, thinking, you know, having young boys, and I know you have kids as well, and all the parents out there, like, you kind of get crazy in those phases when the kids aren't sleeping well. And, it, you know, even one night can completely throw you off. But when you get into multiples, it's like, what is happening over here, right?
Well, and also your decision-making just falls off a cliff, right? Like, you go 2-3 days without sleep, bro, like, you are making the worst decisions you can possibly make. And by the way, it tracks in every area of your life. Financial decisions, terrible. Food choice decisions, terrible. Emotional decisions, terrible. Like, the more sleep deprived you are, the worse all this stuff gets.
Yeah. Gosh, we could go for so much longer, but I need to, of course, want to respect your time. But this has been so good, so practical, great things to think about. Also busting some, you know, just some of the narratives out there, at least giving us some other questions to make some different decisions or at least think about these things. So, I mean, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, but a higher thank you. And just especially what you just shared now, like for the work that you've dedicated your energy towards it, it really, of course, I know we're both probably biased in this, but it's probably one of the most important things that we can be focusing on right now. Cause the cascade of events when you're not sleeping well is not good.
Yeah. Yeah. It is truly remarkable. It's so funny to me because it's like, it wasn't like I woke up one day and said, hey, I want to be a sleep doctor. You know, like when I was in school, like I wanted to be a sports psychologist, you know, like I wanted to work with athletes and do all this stuff. And serendipitously, I ended up in a residency program where I had to do a 6-month rotation in the sleep lab. And dude, by the third day, I absolutely fell in love with clinical sleep medicine. And I knew I was never going to change because, like, again, I get the opportunity. I get I'm the fortunate opportunity to help people at a foundational level of who they are as a human, right? Like a lot of people don't get that opportunity to do that on a scale that I'm very fortunate to do. And I feel very fortunate. I feel very, you know, for blessed, I guess is probably the best word for it, being able to kind of do this and be effective.
Well, Dr. Bruce, here's to better sleep and thriving minds, brother. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Wishing everybody out there sweet dreams.
I love that.